Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 51, section 4, which is old single column, page 584. All right. Okay, so remember where we are. We're working on the planetary atoms here, and they gave us, you know, some initial basics about the material sons and daughters, you know, how they get there, how they get to a world like, you know, how our Adam and Eve got here, and you know, what the basic parameters of their missions are. And they use this opportunity to give you, you know, what seems to be a little aside about the six angic races, the six evolutionary races. But remember, it's by no means an aside. You know, think about the previous, you know, section, the Adamic missions. Right? I mean, their main aspects of their mission is biologic uplifter. So who it is that they're uplifting is very relevant to their mission. And remember that besides that immediacy of uplifting, they also oversee the blending and the improvement of those six angic races. Now, in our world, we had the additional pre-sangic race, you know, the Andonites, you know, but the same basic idea is in, you know, is in play. I mean, just because we had that pre-sangic race didn't change the fact that when an Adam and Eve arrive, what they're fundamentally uplifting is the six angic races. You know, how it is that six angic races came to exist is a secondary issue. So that, you know, that that understanding of the differentials of the races is very very much a key part of what they're trained to understand. You know, exactly what makes those races differential, what makes those, you know, a particular race on the higher side rather than the lower side of that strain, what's the most appropriate way to blend those races together. I mean, all the Adam and all the material sons and daughters are being trained in, you know, in that mode. You know, remember, you know, even though we had that pre-sangic race, the planetary prince didn't come until we had the sangic races, because, you know, it really is sort of, when all is said and done, sort of a twist on how you can bring sangic races into existence to have that pre-sangic will, you know, will creature. You know, until you have the sangics, you don't have something that is fundamentally civilizable. All right, so that's what we're looking for is not so immediately the facts of the sangic races. You know, there's other places in the book where they're dealing with those details more, but we're looking at it in the context of the mission of the Adam and Eve. You know, what it is that they have to work with, and what they're, you know, what are the basic elements that they're keeping in mind, you know, as they're engaging those sangic races. All right, let's see what they got here.
Section 4, the six evolutionary races. The race of dominance during the early ages of the inhabited worlds is the red man, who ordinarily is the first to attain human levels of development. But while the red man is the senior race of the planet, the succeeding colored peoples begin to make their appearances very early in the age of mortal emergence.
Okay, so just that one little tidbit to give us a point of reflection. Again, we're looking for the kind of the really overarching aspects of the races. Okay, so we've talked about this whole issue of, you know, why are they biologically uplifting? What's fundamentally missing from the evolutionary stock? There's distinct limits of how high a quality of mind a mortal can have without that uplift. Right? You have, without that uplift, you have a very limited relationship to the seventh adjutant, which means you have a very limited relationship to the Holy Spirit, which means you have a very limited relationship with your adjuster and with the Spirit of Truth. Right? It's all predicated on the seventh adjutant having that seventh adjutant being able to engage and establish a foundation for the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, right, to provide an actual neck for the hourglass. And how efficiently can you work through the seventh adjutant to get at the Spirit ministries? The other six adjutants don't give you any direct connection to Spirit ministries. You can have the religious impulse, the sixth adjutant, until you're blue in the face, and in and of itself, it doesn't give you any relationship to your adjuster, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, nothing. Right? It's not religion, it's just a religious impulse. It's the precursor. The only way to get to the Spirit ministries is through the philosophic impulse. And without that biologic uplift, you don't have very much. You just have the minimum amount to be human, but you're trying to sort of open up that doorway with that biologic uplift and give you more potential relationship to the Spirit ministries. Right? So that's you want to be thinking about that right up front. Okay, before I go on.
So how think about biologics, and you keep talking about. You think about DNA and things like that. I mean, how do you envision that, you are, quote unquote, how does biology fit into spirit uplifting? In other words,
other than these issues like spirit receptivity, like we talked about back in the different types of mortals and how certain, hormone chemistry and whatnot affects that, and setting all those details aside, the basic issue is, you're starting with your material identity. You're starting with matter. The only way to get to spirit is through mind. Right? There's no direct path from matter to spirit. The only way to get to spirit is through mind. Okay? And mind is a whole spectrum. Matter's at one end, spirit substance is at the other end. And so the higher you're working in the mind energy system, the closer you are to the spirit ministries on the other end of the mind energy spectrum.
And that's determined biologically?
Yes. Okay. Right. So all of that adjutant mind that is your means to spirit energy, or to spirit ministry, all of that adjutant mind is predicated on matter, on biology, on genetics. If your genetics is limited, you have limited seating of the adjutants, which means you have limited means to spirit.
Still get there, it's just a whole lot harder, so to speak.
Right. If you're human, it means you at least have a little swizzle stick connection to spirit. Okay, but you're looking for a fire hose. Okay. Right? To try to bring anything of consequence from spirit ministry down into your mind through a swizzle stick, you're not gonna get much. The whole point is you need to open up that potential. So that's the whole point is, and the fact that you can just literally visualize in the hourglass analogy, I've got the six adjutants in the lower domain, and the only way I can get to the spirit ministries that impact the upper domain is through the neck, where the seventh adjutant is on the third level of meaning. That is the means to that. Right? So you've got seven races normally, the six sanghic races, and the violet race, the Adamic race. You've got seven adjutants, right? Each Sangic race favors one of the first six adjutants. The violet race favors the seventh adjutant. So they come to biologically uplift you and give you that bias towards the means to the greater end, the means to get up, okay? And right here when they said, okay, this is bringing me around to the statement here. So the race of dominance during the early ages of the inhabited worlds is the red man, okay? Now you could just read that and try to memorize that, or you could ask why and figure it out and then never have to, you know, memorize anything. Just so why is it? Why would the red man ordinarily be the first to attain human levels of development? Yeah, so remember, normally on a world when you don't have the Andonites, when you don't have the pre-Sangic race, you've got the colored races coming into existence one at a time out of pre-human stock. Right? You've got fancy animals, just literally, factually, pre-human stock, and one day twins of the red race are born from that pre-human stock. And the red race begins. And then sometime down the road, you know, you've got some more pre-human stock. And one day, there's two humans, a male and female pair, that are born out of that. And that's the first pair of orange men, et cetera, all the way, you know, through to indigo. So you've had that normal, you know, rainbow spectrum sequence, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, through the six Sangic races normally. Each of them, you know, coming into existence independently. Not like it did here, where you had the Andonites, you know, as that first pair of humans, and an Infanta, and then out of the Andonites came all six races. See, normally the colored races are coming out of animals, not out of humans. You know, here they came out of humans. Right? Normally they're coming out of animals, one at a time. Okay, and the red man is first, the orange man is second, etc. Okay, so why? Why is red man dominant? Why does he poke out of the animal nature first? Why does he pop his head up above the sea of animal pre-human nature
as
first?
As opposed to blue or
whatever. Why red first? Okay. So red man favors the sixth adjutant. You know, maybe we should down here. Let's just hold up the threefold actuality with unity chart. Right? You know, and so you can, you know, remember that when you put the adjutants on the chart here, there's two, if you, in this field number three here, 3A and 3B, you got two adjutants in each of these blocks, each of the 3A, 3B blocks. You've got the first adjutant and the fourth here in this first block. You've got the second adjutant and the fifth, and you've got the third adjutant and the sixth. As you go from individuality to associativity to unity, you got those six adjutants. So red man favors, well, let's start on here. So red man favors the sixth adjutant, orange the third, yellow, see how there's a pattern what I'm doing here? Yellow the fifth, green the second, blue the fourth, indigo the first adjutant. Okay? All right? And if you look down in the block here, here's the seventh adjutant down in the fourth block here, okay, and that's, you know, that's the violet race. Okay, so think about that. If the secondary Sangics favor the first three adjutants, the primary Sangics favor the second three adjutants. That's why they're different like that. One's primary and one's secondary. Red man is favoring the sixth adjutant. So, you know, he's going to have all seven adjutants seated, right? When he become, you know, when you have those first two red man humans, right? And you're going to have all seven adjutants. But that pre-human stock that's heading towards that end of having all seven adjutants engage has an innate bias, you know, probably going way, way back in the lineage, you know, way back in pre-human nature, there's a bias towards the sixth adjutant. Long before the sixth adjutant is connected, The genetics that's coming up is the potential there is biased towards the sixth. You know, and you're actualizing the potential and actualizing the potential, and the fourth adjutant connects, the fifth adjutant connects, right? Then the sixth adjutant connects. So think about it. Of all, it's not surprising that the first one out of the gate, as it were, would be the one that favors the sixth adjutant, so that it favors that immediate pre-human nature. All you have to do is just add the seventh and you're done. Right? It seems to make complete sense, right? That one would come out first, rather than if it favored the first, it's like it's going to be kind of satisfied right there, and you're going to have to slowly through, you know, eventually you'll get the other ones, you know, and you get to seventh. So it seems to make a lot of sense that red man would come out first. Okay, however, if you just think like that, you think, well, okay, so wouldn't yellow man be second then, favoring the fifth? Right? So that's what, you know, so when you you're going, if you just figured out the adjutant colored race pairing, and that's all the revelators, you know, all they told you is what would allow you to finally, you know, recognize that they're matched up like that, each one favors an adjutant. And they left it at that, you would assume that the order, you know, would be the three primaries and then the three secondaries, right? Okay, so, oh, you go, ah, that's why they have to tell us that, because you're not going to deduce that. None of us know the physics enough to know that actually the primaries and secondaries are interleaved, and it goes red, orange, yellow, rather than red, yellow. Okay? But so they just tell you that. But the fact that you now know that, because they just told you that they come out in that order, that's telling you something in retrospect. Okay, so in other words, you know, we saw that we could go up this chart. We had the two unity ones first, then the two associativity ones, and then the two individuality ones, that they were going in that order. Oh, so even though I can't really as intuitively follow the physics of it, apparently, if my genetics favors the third adjutant, even though that's an in the moment and not a long term favoritism of unity nature, that's enough. It's like a mustard seed thing. Right? Jesus said that, you know, that when you're talking about this spirit thing, it's like a mustard seed. It only takes a little bit to have a big impact. So even that in the moment relationship to unity that the third adjutant gives you is enough to trump the other four adjutants getting ahead of the process. Because remember, what we're trying to get to is something that can be encircuited in the Holy Spirit and can have spirit pattern, personality, identify with it. Right? See, so that favoritism of unity, you know, spiritual nature of the third and sixth adjutants, see, is what is, you know, taking the lead. And obviously, you know, even logic that we can understand, the red is going to, you know, be ahead of the orange. I mean, it's obviously going to be easier for him to be out front favoring the sixth than it is for orange man favoring the third. But the fact that favoring the third trumps, say, favoring the fifth, and he comes out before yellow man, so he's telling you something about the physics of it, that the bias towards unity trumps even a long-term bias towards associativity or a long-term bias towards individuality, like blue man. Okay? I see. So you take what they tell you directly, which, you know, if they tell you directly, that means you can't figure it out yourself. You combine that with what you can figure out yourself from what they do tell you, and then you get the whole picture, and you can start to kind of understand how this works a little bit, even though none of us know the complexities of how adjutant mind attunes to chromosomes and all that sort of stuff.
But maybe someday we will.
And someday we will. Someday we have to, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but because, you know, someday we're going to have to be genetically re-engineering the DNA so that mind seats on it better. Right? The whole point of genetic engineering of mortals on worlds is not to change the shape of your big toe. Right? That's irrelevant.
Yeah.
right? And remember, in terms of the basic physiology, that reached its natural apex 40,000 years ago, and we were basically Adamic-like 40,000 years ago. That's why Adam and Eve can come and mate, right? Their children can mate, right? You've gotten up to them. But the difference is mind, not matter. The thing that you're uplifting is not the big toe. It's the adjutant mind, right? That somehow, in a very mysterious way, is attuned to the shape of your big toe, right? But you're going to be modifying the genetics. For instance, you know, the big thing we need to do is get more seventh adjutant to engage us by modifying the genetics so that we can engage the Holy Spirit more, and et cetera, right? Okay, so just, you know, reflecting on that basic pairing of the adjutants with the races, you can begin to understand a little bit better what's going on. And see, as they're blending these races then, you know, what they're blending them not so that, you know, they get an improved body morphology or something, right? The whole point is they're trying to get them to have adjutant mind attuned to it more efficiently, more extensively. That's the whole point.
So they're not changing mind per se. They're modifying our potential to engage mind.
Right. They're modifying what the mind is going to attune to. The mind attuning it's a creative mother spirit's mind. You know, it's up to her, not up to Adam and Eve's or life carriers or whatever. You know, they aren't holding on to mind and twisting it and making it fit better or something.
I just wanted to clarify that.
I mean, all they can do is supply the favorable conditions for mind to attune better. And then it's in the hands of the creative mother spirit to actually attune that mind better. Right? But they know all the physics of it. You know, they've gone through it a gazillion times. I mean, they know if you can put molecules in this arrangement, you know, the third adjutant seats better, right? If you have this sequence of, you know, of genes, and if you have this set of chromosomes, you know, that alters the way the fourth adjutant seats. And, you know, I mean, they understand all that stuff, right? You know, and they understand it so well that they can start with single-celled plants, right? They know so well how mind over-controls matter that they know that those single-celled plants are going to end up with Andon and Fonta, like in our case, right? With the adjutants attuned in a certain way. And right? See, and again, just think about that. See, what they're trying to do is get it so that you had a race that didn't have a bias toward any one adjutant, but was equally favoring all adjutants. See, it's like a pre-blended race, like I say. I mean, see, if you blend all the races together, you have something that doesn't have this bias towards one adjutant or another.
That was the experiment,
yeah. Right, and that's the experiment of having the Andonites. See, you have a race that inherently engages all the adjutants equally. Now, it engages them at a very minimal level, but it does so in a symmetric way, whereas no colored race engages the adjutants in a symmetric way. They all are oblong, you know, they're all biased to one adjutant or another inherently, right? So much so that you have to resurrect them in separate resurrection halls, right? The mind energy is so radically different the way it attunes, right? That was the experiment, to have kind of a super downstepped, upstepped blended race, right? If you take the one race that's been upstepped by Adam and Eve, so all the Sangic biases are symmetric now and upstepped. You take the essence of that and you downstepped it all the way below Sangic level, you get an Andonite. You get a foretaste of the feast to come, right? You get this faint flicker of the goal, right? The end from the beginning, right? They're trying to seed a better harmonization at the end by giving it harmony to begin with, rather than giving it diversity and then just letting the evolutionary forces slowly harmonize it. They're trying to bias it towards harmony to begin with, and that's what they're doing. No, you know, it didn't work out, you know, exactly like they hoped, but...
Right? We got better toes.
But nonetheless, I mean, you know, no matter how much rebellion and default there was, it doesn't change the fact that some of the things that the action of Adam and Eve would normally do with their upstepping and their coordination of blending was done for them. It's inherent in the Adamites, right? The rudimentary parts of that they weren't going to have to do because it happened automatically, naturally, by having that pre-blended race of the Adamites. So that's one of the reasons why we aren't as hopeless as we might be because of the default, because it was kind of built in a little bit. All of us are resting on the laurels of our Adonic stock a bit. All right.
They were planning to do something
with right, they were,
that we
right.
missed out on.
Yeah, they were definitely planning on blowing on that little faint flicker of potential a bit, right? But nonetheless, okay. Okay, yeah, now that thing, that's that element, that it's literally the same order as, you know, when a prism, like a raindrop, you know, spreads white light into a spectrum. You know, the Revelators mention that in passing, that's telling you something about a deep level of physics in the universe, right? It's much more profound than humans have ever imagined, that when you shine white light through a prism of glass, it comes out red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. I mean, there's something deeply universal about that sequence that's waiting for us to discover.
The infinite has that spectrum.
Yeah, it's inherent somehow, and they're telling you it's a very ubiquitous thing that you'll see pop out in various ways, and it all has one source. See, somewhere deep in the physics of matter, mind, and spirit energy together in triunity and everything. I mean, it's inherent. It's not just a physical thing, you know. It's more universal than that. And they don't explain. Apparently, we can eventually figure that out. But there's a spot in the book where they say, "Don't dismiss that. That's not just a coincidence. That's something you need to hold in your mind and figure out someday. That's a huge clue about something," is basically they say. And then they move on to the next subject. Yeah. All right. Okay, right here they don't, when they say the appearance is very early in the age of mortal emergence, that last little statement there in that paragraph, they elaborate in other places, and we'll get to that. Eventually here, you know, kind of the normal time scale for all the Sangic races to come about. But in the big picture, you know, it's not all in one family like it had with us, but, you know, relatively it's in a short order. You don't go for endless ages with only the first, you know, only red, orange, yellow, say, or something. I mean, you know, in relatively short order, they chug their way into existence and you have all six, okay? All right.
The earlier races are somewhat superior to the later. The red man stands far above the indigo, black race. The life carriers impart the full bestowal of the living energies to the initial or red race, and each succeeding evolutionary manifestation of a distinct group of mortals represents variation at the expense of the original endowment. Even mortal stature tends to decrease from the red man down to the indigo race, although on Urantia unexpected strains of giantism appeared among the green and orange peoples.
Okay, so a number of things there. Again, just these little tidbits about the races, not a, you know, a lot right here. But let's deal with that last little thing first about the giantism. Okay, remember they... it's important in this paper, they just told you what the normal height of material sons and daughters is, 8 to 10 feet. Right? So they're pointing out that in our case, we had unexpected strains of giantism in the green and the orange. Okay, now think about what I just said. Okay, remember our colored races all came out of the Adonites. And the Andonites, in a sense, are like really, really minimalized, completed product, right? You know, post-uplift, blended. Okay? Hey, you know, so that stock that is coming in from the material sons and daughters that has an 8 to 10 range on it, you're getting a little bit of that 8 to 9 foot with the giantism. Doesn't go all the way to 10. But see, the very fact that you can have that giantism, it's kind of reminding you that in a way the Andonites are kind of like Adamic, only really, really minimalized. But there's this recessive Adamic nature. And so every once in a while, that recessive Adamic nature would burst out in the green and the orange, and you'd get something that's kind of more material son and daughter sort of height. Right? You know, even taller than red. Okay? So that's what's going on there. But now, why green and orange? Okay, you need to understand the physics of all this more. And that's kind of mostly what they're doing in that paragraph, is giving you some hints that I can't unpack fully about, you know, that there's some sort of kind of overarching thing, independent of all the details, that's being diminished as you go red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. And it's so definitive of a thing that their height diminishes, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. I mean, why do you have pygmies? You know, when you've got a lot of indigo stock, right? It's because they're the shortest of all six. Right, so they're giving you little hints there. The more we understand the physics of this, the more we could appreciate, and probably see, if we didn't have these little hints, we couldn't sort it out. So they give you these little hints. That's what they're doing there. Now, the one little technical detail. You know, obviously we use the expression black man, okay, the black race. You know, anyone who's actually looked closely knows that, you know, there's all kinds of different shades and even coloration, you know, color differentials among quote-unquote black people. Most of the time in the book, the relators are just trying to help us to understand that when they say indigo, that's what you tend to call black, right? Because what you tend to call black is predominantly indigo stock. Right? So especially here, the very first time they do it in the book, right? When they say indigo race, it's sort of just this little footnote. You know, you notice the deep parentheticals, not even with commas, but with M dashes, right? This little footnote. It's like, and by indigo, we mean what you normally call black, right? Now, that's not always true. It's not always the case that their use of black is just kind of for our benefit, you know, quote-unquote black, what you call black. Sometimes they mean it more technically, because they'll actually talk about a contrast between indigo and black rather than being synonyms. So it isn't quote-unquote black anymore. It's more directly, they mean black, okay? And what are they, when they do that in the book, that's because if you combine the three secondary sangics, if you combine orange, green, indigo, right, you get very, very dark brown, quote-unquote black, right? And so sometimes they're talking about, well, you got more pure indigo, right? And if you go to, you know, if you look at some people, say in Africa, you know, or Southeast Asia, you can see it some too, right, you know, you look at their skin, it's like, whoa, they're really basically indigo, aren't they? They've got a lot of real indigo hue to their. Right? So if sometimes they're talking about, okay, if some of those quote-unquote black people, if you look closely, right, they really have an awful lot of indigo. They're mostly indigo, you know, and you can tell that just by looking at them. But some of those quote-unquote black people are black people, right? I mean, some of them in Africa, say, you know, there's nothing indigo about, or orange, or anything about their. I mean, they're you know, they're ebony colored. They're basically black. That if you see someone like that, that means they've got a pretty even blend of the three secondary sangics. Right? They've got a fair amount of orange, you know, and green blended into that indigo, so that they actually are the black, you know, race, right? I mean, in Kenya, say the Kikuyu tribe, okay, they're very much like that. You know, other tribes, you know, in Africa, you know, whereas some places you go in Africa and if you look, it's like, oh, well, actually, there's a lot of orange. I mean, the orange dominates the skin tone here in this person. You know, like I said, others indigo. You know, and if you look, you can occasionally find someone where it's green. You know, they probably have all three, but there's quite a bit of green, and they can come off quite green. I've seen it in African, you know, sangic blends. You can also see it in the subcontinent of India, right? And you can also see it in some of those Indian stocks, where especially if you get good bright light on their skin, you know, so it isn't just kind of lost in the.
You brought in the pictures one day.
Right, and then on top of that, you know, if you go, you can find pockets of quite relatively pure stock, you know, where there's nothing sort of quasi indigo about, you know, this very short, roundy, statured human. I mean, you can tell they're basically pure indigo, very, very indigo. And, you know, there's just nothing brownish or anything about their skin, you know, at all.
I don't think of black people as necessarily being short in this country.
Okay, yeah, well, and why don't we think of a lot of black people as being short? You just read it.
Giant.
Right, there's, you know, they brought in giant strains of green and orange, right? You know, and so you look at some of those tribes in Africa where the average height is 7 foot, right? You know, there were some people in the ancient past who were very delighted about mating with those giant strains, right? I mean, right? I mean, you got male and female, you know, over 7 foot in those tribes, right? I mean, they got a lot of that giant strain. You know, you take indigo, short stature, you blend it with something that's 8 to 9 feet tall, okay, and you're going to get an average height of 7 foot, right? Right, so all of the quote-unquote black people on the planet that have any significant height to them, it's because of those giant strains, right? Okay, unless, of course, you know, there's slavery and they've got some Mandite blood blended in, and that's given some more height. I mean, obviously, that can give them some more height, too. But I mean, in terms of more, you know, aboriginal stock peoples, right, if they're tall, it's because of the giant strains. And just, you know, a little aside, remember how this went. The orange man was heading into that area first, and green followed him, conquered the orange. You know, and of course, that means basically they're killing off all the male oranges and mating with the female oranges. Right? So the orange gets blended into the green when the green conquers the orange. And then along comes the indigo last and conquers the remaining, you know, green-orange blend. And again, you know, you're basically going to be killing off males and mating with the females, you know, when you do that. And so that's, you know, how you got it. And so you've got some stocks that have, you know, a really solid blend of orange, green, and indigo. Others, you know, once they're conquered and kind of absorbed, I mean, you can have other indigos coming in afterwards, and they basically are not going to have much of anything except their original indigo, you know, and little shades of stuff that they get, you know, incidentally. You know, and there, by and large, though, like the Revelators say, there's really no pure stocks anywhere on the planet. You know, but we obviously have peoples where they got an awful lot of yellow and an awful lot of red and an awful lot of indigo. And you know.
Chris?
Yep.
So when we hear them talking about one or the other, we can maybe personally identify tendencies that we have. But when we walk around and we look at people, maybe we shouldn't generalize and say, oh yeah, that one's that and that one's that.
But you definitely see, you know, what we can generally call black men, not surprisingly, they tend to be more naturally athletic because the indigo stock favors the first adjutant, right? That adjutant of athletics, right? The adjutant that you're teaching, that teachable mind that you're teaching that's the most immediately connected to the body. I mean, that's why they are so much more natural, because they that indigo stock favors the first adjutant. And that's just why they're more naturally athletic. Right? You know, or if you favor, if there's some blue stock which favors the fourth adjutant, you know, so it's going to, in a rudimentary sense, it's going to favor tool making. I mean, is it surprising that a lot of that sort of tool making, you know, concept of the Industrial Revolution is predicated on some solid blue man, you know, being there to some degree in Europe? You know, and, you know, you can, you know, why is all that yellow man stock in far, you know, the Far East so naturally communal in consciousness? Why do they kind of naturally like a collective sort of existence as opposed to a rugged individualistic existence like the blue man favoring the individuality, you know, adjutant? Right, I mean, they're favoring the associativity adjutant of the fifth adjutant, the social impulse, right? So, right, the sons of Han are going to just very naturally have an affinity to collective existence, right? And Red Man, you know, just can't help but have this bias towards the sixth adjutant. So he's always thinking, you know, and blurring, wanting to blur everything into a spirit unity. You know, their God is the Great Spirit, right? And you want to think animistically. You know, you just kind of, you know, it's so their religious tendencies are spiritistic, right? Where you don't really have individuality, but you just have, you know, the unity of the Great Spirit, and he's in every rock and every tree and every, right? Right? They favor that unity consciousness, right? That's just what they do naturally.
My wife wants to be a little bit red.
Now, I remember in Northern Europe, right? You know, aside from getting the Andite blood, you know, getting some Adamic blood, you know, coming in, you've got blue man with some red and yellow blended in. It was the precursor. In Northern Europe, in Northern Europe, you know, you have your precursor to the Andite, you know, infusion is blue with some red and yellow blended in, right? And so, in my case, I mean, I definitely have some favoritism in my skin pigment to the red man that's in me in, you know, ancient past. It has nothing to do with anything that happened in North America, right? It goes all the way back to, you know, Europe, you know, Northern European continent stock, you know. So if I get a lot of sun, if I carefully don't burn myself, you know, I don't tan brown, I tan red. I have a very, you know, and you can look at your pigment if you're basically Caucasian. You know, if you put my arm next to yours and you go, oh, my arm, you know, your arm is more yellow than mine. It's because you have more yellow man pigment in, you know, than I do. I don't really have much yellow man pigment in me. Got a lot of red man pigment, you know. So you can see these little differentials. You know, that's the fun thing. All those little hints they give you in various spots in the book help you to kind of unpack what happened with you in the ancient past. Now, oh, maybe just one more thing before we get back to the reading, because we're kind of going way astray here. But remember the problem with sort of the random blending that has occurred on this planet. Because the blending wasn't overseen, instead of having them oversee our blending so that they get the currents in our mind to kind of sync up, if you just randomly blend these different biases of the different sanguic stocks, instead of getting sort of a better one current, you get cross currents in the mind. Right? And so my blue man tendency wants to go this direction, and my red man tendency wants to go this direction, you know, orthogonal to it, and I have this turmoil inside where I'm being torn at right angles. Right? And they point out that's the biggest problem on the planet, why the adjusters can do very little with us. Because there's no harmony in our mind. Our minds are all these cross currents because we have this random blending of the different currents of the adjutants of the sanguic races. You know, no one oversaw them so that they kind of work together in harmony. They've just been randomly plopped together at right angles to one another. And so we're this pile of pixie sticks, you know, in our mind, you know, going every which direction. Right, and you obviously have the ability to move up and get above all, you know, most of those issues, right? But again, there's going to be limits, right?
If that wasn't the case, then there would be no point in being here, for instance.
If we didn't have the potential to overcome all those cross currents to some degree, it would be a complete waste of time for Jesus to come here as a bestowal son and pour out the Spirit of Truth upon all flesh, because the Spirit of Truth couldn't do anything.
He did,
right?
In 30 years.
It'd be a complete waste of time to send the Spirit of Truth to the individuals that were nothing but cross currents and couldn't overcome them in any way, right? But you're going to have to take delight in cultivating. More than the run-of-the-mill human that got the proper blending, you're going to have to really set your mind to this to go up. You're not going to naturally be up there.
No.
Right? You're naturally going to be down in this pile of cross currents and eddies and whatnot. That's where we are naturally.
Until we can get that biological elixir.
Yeah. So that which you didn't get, you know, just, you know, this uplift, you know, by Adamic infusion, right? You're going to have to choose to go up.
Yeah.
Right? All right. Okay. Meanwhile, back to.
Chris?
Yep.
So of course you've opened this can and.
Oh, I opened the can of worms.
Kristen needs to know. What do we know about the Hebrew genetics?
We don't want to go into all that right now. That's in later parts of the book that give you all that stuff. You know, wait to do that in context. You know, what kind of stock was in the Levant and those sorts of things.
I'd rather talk about the Italian.
That all comes out, you know, in the course of the book.
Same answer. Bada bing.
Yeah. Remember what I said up front, because I knew this was going to happen. The point here is not to go into all the details, especially the geographic details of the Sangic races. Right? The point is just to remind yourself of what it is that Adam and Eve are coming to do. They've got this stock of six races. Each favors one adjutant. They come to try to get each of those biases coordinated together and uplift it. That's what they're trying to do. Yeah.
On those worlds having all six evolutionary races, the superior peoples are the first, third, and fifth races, the red, the yellow, and the blue. The evolutionary races thus alternate in capacity for intellectual growth and spiritual development, the second, fourth, and sixth being somewhat less endowed. These secondary races are the peoples that are missing on certain worlds. They are the ones that have been exterminated on many others. It is a misfortune on Urantia that you so largely lost your superior blue men. Except as they persist in your amalgamated white race. The loss of your orange and green stocks is not of such serious concern.
Okay, so we already kind of said the first part there. When you know which adjutants they're favoring, obviously the ones that favor the long-term adjutants, in contrast to the in-the-moment adjutants, the ones that favor 6, 5, and 4, right? The red, yellow, and blue, like they just said, those are going to be naturally, have a natural superior mental activity, right? They're just going to much more naturally, in one way or another, be able to put themselves in a more long-term perspective. It's, you know, obviously, if you can't get out of the moment a bit, there's no way you can reflect very well. You know, you're just so. If you're favoring one of the first three adjutants, you tend to be kind of just stuck down in the moment.
Cell phone all day long.
You know, the cell phone man that's, you know, staring at their hand all day, right? You know, and especially, you know, I mean, the indigo, okay, at least he's in the moment, but he's really grounded, okay, with the first adjutant. But poor orange and green, right? I mean, they're favoring an in-the-moment thing that's sort of floating, you know, and not grounded. You know, so you can see why it was so easy for indigo to conquer them. I mean, you know, they're caught in the moment, and, you know, and then they get their head cut off, right? I mean, they're going to have a hard time.
Oh, my gosh.
They're going to have a hard time laying big plans in order to win, you know, battles and stuff. They're going to get, you know, right? I mean, think about poor Green Man who favors his rationalization engine, right? He's going to be sitting there spinning, and, you know, I mean, it's just easy to just walk up to him, chop their heads off, right? He's just, you know, he's just going to be lost in the whole process, and, you know, he's going to be overwhelmed.
So
but that's the way that's the way it went, right? You know, and when they say the loss of your orange and green stocks is not of such serious concern, you know, like take green for example. Do we have a real need for more insane rationalizing on this planet? Are we missing, you know, are we at a deficit of rationalization? Do we need more second adjutant churning it? No, we got more than we need right now. And so that's, now remember too, you know, and they say on those worlds that have all six, remember we talked about that some before. I mean, there's whole local systems, remember, that kind of just have the three races, the three primaries, you know, don't have any secondaries. And remember, three brainer worlds, you know, most of them only have the three primaries, no secondaries. So, so again, that's just reminding you that there's a lot of automatic to the first three adjutants. They're so foundational and level of the flesh, right? You know, if all you're looking for is actualizing potentials in mortal will creatures where it's predicated on the first three adjutants, you just have the first three adjutants and you don't, you know, biases are not needed. But if you add in that addition of not just the foundation of the first three, but the three different biases on that foundation, there's new potentials. And so that's what you're doing on worlds that have all six. It's like, well, what if you combine, you know, that bias with this bias in a wise way? You know, you get a super additive consequence that you can't have if you don't. You know, so again, you have these biases because the whole point is to get things off the neutral point, differentiate. You know, what I'm calling a bias is a differentiation. You know, and in that differential, there's a super additive potential. That's the whole point.
Okay. Chris?
Yep.
When you're talking about the supervising the blending of the races, on a normal world, you're talking about the prince's staff doing this?
The prince's staff doesn't do it very much. I mean, just in a rudimentary fashion. It doesn't really start in earnest until the material son and daughter. It's Adam and Eve's job to really oversee the blending of the races.
So up until that time, they're pretty much, the races are separate.
They're pretty much separate. They're gonna mention here in just a couple paragraphs a little bit of the tendency that happens before Adam and Eve.
You know. Then Adams and Eve actually come in and manage, right. Micromanage.
Right. They oversee, you know, all of the details of that blending. Yeah. The prince's staff are kind of just letting things naturally run their course. Because remember, the whole biologic evolution is still in play.
Right.
Right. It, you know, it doesn't reach its apex until, you know, Adam and Eve come, right? I mean, that's why they come.
So yeah. The biologic evolution is within a certain race, really, at that point?
Mostly, yeah, within a certain race. And then whatever just kind of happens naturally amongst the races before that, they just sort of let supremacy, you know, let the supreme just do whatever it wants to do, right, before Adam and Eve come in and say, okay, now the supreme has done everything it can do. That's why we're here. So now we're going to stick our fingers into it and, you know, and actively inject our will into the process.
And then as they get the races blended, they start sending their progeny out.
Yeah, we'll get to that sort of stuff, yeah, in a little bit, yeah.
But they're the supreme's will too, aren't they?
Well, you'll see in a little bit here. let's just wait on that. We're getting ahead of ourselves. All right. Let's see here. What else do we have there? I kind of lost my place here. Let's see. Right, that, you know, they're the ones that have been exterminated on many others. Remember, it's very, you know, they just point that out. It's very common for the secondary sanghics to get wiped out in large numbers because, again, there's just, you know, they're so in the moment. They're always going to be at a disadvantage in long-term planning and, you know, and stuff like war planning. They're just never going to do it as well. You know, and especially bringing Blue Man with, you know, and some favoritism for getting more sophisticated tools of war, right? And those that don't have any tendency to have fancier tools of war are going to lose in war, right?
Got some nice mounds.
Okay. Right, so then just, okay, the one last thing there is, okay, so, you know, it's a misfortune on your rancho that you so largely lost your superior Blue Man. Okay, and they said misfortune, so they're pointing out that, you know, it impacts unity by using that mis prefix. It means there's a badness to the situation. So, you know, I mean, if you, to not have, you know, sort of the ability to have an equally strong second level of meaning, be able to bring all three adjutants in kind of equal play, the fourth, fifth, and sixth, that's going to hinder your relationship to the spirit ministries, you know, in the end. So that's, they're saying that's unfortunate.
It would be the spirit of knowledge, but that kind of plays into the logical acumen, the individuality.
Right, if you want to think about it in just a simple kind of one-to-one sort of way, you can think of it like that, that might hinder your relationship to the first cosmic intuition, kind of in just a direct way, but in a more indirect way, just holistically, right? You know, you're trying to get up into a relationship with the whole, and you're doing that in stages. There's a wholeness to the first three adjutants, and a wholeness to the second three adjutants, right? And if you don't have the blue to kind of properly mix with the yellow and red, it's hard to get that precursor wholeness, right? The next step up of wholeness. So that, you know, that's what I was more speaking to. And now the quote-unquote, you know, here they actually do the quote-unquote white race. You know, even like I said, it was basically quote-unquote black race up there, too. And what is that? Like I said, it ends up being quote-unquote white because you take the three primaries and you blend them together. So you take the red and the yellow and the blue, which gives you basically light brown. Right? And so you take that light brown and then you bring in a whole bunch of non-colored, lack of pigment, Adamic stock, and you dilute that light brown until it's so light brown it's white. Right? And that's how you get quote-unquote white rice. Right? You just dilute the secondary Sangic brown, I mean the primary Sangic brown, excuse me, the primary Sangic brown, you know, down to just a completely washed out white.
That takes you back to your spectrum idea of the seven colors and the white and how there's more to it.
Right. So the beautiful thing is, see, all this plays together and gets you to think about, there's some really fancy physics going on here.
Well, they call the Adamic race the violet race.
Right, but that hasn't done anything to do with skin pigment.
No.
Right. You know, that has to do with the glow from, you know, the interaction of the mechanical mind.
So
with
you think the Adamites lacked skin?
Yeah, they're basically, yeah, they are lily white.
Poor guys. If you get any on, you would bleach it.
Yeah. So they go to a world with ultraviolet, and they're motivated to actually get some skin pigment. Yeah, we ought to blend with some pigment. It might be handier. All right. So that's the basics of what's going on there. All right, let's keep going.
The evolution of six or of three colored races, while seeming to deteriorate the original endowment of the red man, provides certain very desirable variations in mortal types and affords an otherwise unattainable expression of diverse human potentials. These modifications are beneficial to the progress of mankind as a whole, provided they are subsequently upstepped by the imported Adamic or Violet race. On Urantia, this usual plan of amalgamation was not extensively carried out, and this failure to execute the plan of race evolution makes it impossible for you to understand very much about the status of these peoples on an average inhabited planet by observing the remnants of these early races on your world.
Okay. I didn't fully answer your question because I was waiting for us to actually read about it here with the Violet race. Okay. So, I alluded to, though, there's some really fancy physics going on here. So think about this. You know, they do call them the Violet race, and it's not because their skin pigment is violet. Right? It isn't like just as the six Sangiks where you actually have skin pigment, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. You go one more notch, and instead of having skin pigment that's violet, you have this energy, this visible light coming from the interaction of the mechanical mind with the material energy system of the being's body and producing a violet, light. So think about what you've done. And this should have struck you a long time ago, right? I mean, you learn very early on reading this book that red is superior to indigo, right? And yet the most superior of the seven races is the violet. Shouldn't he be, next to the red man in the sequence? Why is he next to the indigo man? Right? So is the indigo man really the lowest? If he's closest to the highest, the violet race, in terms of the sequence of colors?
Depends which way you look at it.
Right, depends which way you look at it. Who, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. Who's lowest and who's highest? Well, it depends on which way you look at it. Both are true. They're both first and they're both last in certain ways. And to see what actually happens, you get to that indigo man, right, and he's favoring the first adjutant. The first adjutant is the adjutant that's most immediately in touch with the mechanical mind. That violet color is coming from the mechanical mind that's engaging those Adamic peoples. That's why they told us about that earlier in this paper, right? So we can have that in mind and be thinking about that. And it literally, and the color shifts from being sort of directly a material energy phenomenon to a rudimentary mind energy phenomenon. So the color spectrum, it's showing you that fundamentally, remember, all energies are part of a triunity in a bigger sense, right? And so you're literally seeing that the color shifts from being something that's on the skin and, relative directly to the matter, and is shifting over into the mind, more just a function of mind energy. And I could go on a little bit more with that, but we don't want to go too far. But you just so you see that sense, it's you have simple signs of the wholeness of everything. And they use that word. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
These modifications are beneficial to the progress of mankind as a whole. Right? You can see how you're getting shades of this wholeness. And they, of course, were telling you what I was just saying a minute ago. The whole point is to get the differential, so that you have a potential that you wouldn't have normally. Otherwise unattainable expression of diverse human potentials. Right? A potential is a differential. Right? There can't be any super additive consequence until there's that differential. So that's the whole point. And so even though you have to seemingly go down to get more differential, when all is said and done, like I said, especially once you've got the sort of the juice that brings it all together, the Adamic uplift, it all ends up elevated. You have to go down first so that you can end up higher last. So it's like we were just saying, is it really down? Right? not if you look at it in terms of its potential. The farther down you go, the more potential it is to go higher in the end. As long as it's done properly. Now, if no one oversees this, what you're going to have is something that just drags everything down. In order to get that that super additive consequence, it has to be done properly. You can't just let it happen. It doesn't just happen naturally. It has to be personality managed. The universe is mind made and personality managed. You don't get these potentials unless there's management. It doesn't just happen naturally. The universe is artificial. It's an art form, right? Okay. What else do we have there? And kind of between the lines of what they're saying there about how we can't really understand. I mean, obviously we can't understand what it would be like to properly actualize these potentials. But we can't even really fully appreciate the potentials because we can't really observe any of the pure races to really kind of see the potentials in a pure fashion. We have all of these haphazard crossbreeds, right? And so we see, it's going to accentuate problematic aspects, and it's going to be harder to see the positive potentials in the midst of all these kind of random, unfortunate negative actuals, because this wasn't overseen, this whole blending of the stocks. And so, and especially as we're about to read, no one oversaw taking the lesser elements out of these stocks before any blending happened, or even any within a race, breeding. Right, so you have all kinds of negative recessive stuff because that stuff wasn't taken out. So it's very hard for us to appreciate what incredible potential pure indigo stock had, because when we see basic black man, and I'm just picking on them, it's true of anything else, same is true for white race, whatever. They've got all of these unmanaged aspects to them, that are dragging them down, and we're judging them by how they've been drugged down by no fault of their own, right? It's Adam and Eve's fault that no one was overseeing their breeding, right? All right, let's keep going here. Yep.
There's always one of the main challenges for everyone that gets into the Rancher book is the thing about the so-called negative things that are said about the different races, particularly the black or indigo race. And to me, this is an answer that just, I mean, if you have any vision, any distance of vision at all, it should help to alleviate people feeling less or offensive, and that is about there are certain very desirable variations in mortal types, and it affords an otherwise unattainable expression of diverse human potentials. That's what the races are giving us, as you're talking about. And this is the answer to that tough question to me.
Yeah, and again, we existentialize everything. We think God meant there to be indigo peoples or yellow peoples in eternity. No, right? Those are scaffolding phenomena. Right? You completely will misunderstand it if you existentialize it and think God made me this way relative to eternity. No, He didn't. Right? I mean, in very short order, there's supposed to be just one race on a planet. Right? There's nothing, existentially profound about any of the Sangic races or any of our differentials. We love to exalt our differences and think they're somehow the way it's supposed to be in eternity. No, I mean, all of our peculiarities are just, things that are meant to be washed away. They should be all gone by now. Adam and Eve should have done all their work, and there should be just one race on this planet, and we shouldn't have all these people who favor the sixth adjutant or favor the fifth adjutant or all this. All that should be blended away. The point is not to have these eternal differentials. The point is to initially have the differentials and actualize those potentials, and now those differentials are gone. Right? But we want to internalize them, you know. We want to keep this stuff going forever. We want, you know, all the languages of these biases of genetics to last forever. No, all those languages are meant to disappear with time and everything. You know, they're languages of biased mind. You want to eventually have one language of a harmony mind. Predicated on a harmony genetics, right?
Still
ancillary. Yeah. Anyway, all right. Give me one little tidbit here.
In the early days of racial development, there is a slight tendency for the red, the yellow, and the blue men to interbreed. There is a similar tendency for the orange, green, and indigo races to intermingle.
Right, okay. Because you've got the three that are in the moment adjutants, the three that are long-term adjutants, they're going to have, despite their differences, one individuality, one associativity, one unity in terms of their bias, right? They have something in common. They'll feel an affinity, an intellectual affinity, and they'll be attracted to a degree. They have to overcome the skin differences and some things like this, right? And the biases make them think, you know, differently in some ways. But there's going to be a natural tendency to get a light brown man and a dark brown man, right? A primary Sangic blend and a secondary Sangic blend. So without any oversight on this planet, what did we end up with? We ended up with, you know, what we think is three races: Caucasoid, Mongoloid, Negroid. Right, we ended up with, you know, the Caucasoid, where the Andites infusion dominates, and then we ended up with these two that they're talking about. What just happens naturally is you'll get a Sangic, primary Sangic blend. That's what we call Mongoloid, right? Where you have, you know, and of course a lot of that is red and yellow, you know, that we see, and call Mongoloid, and then Negroid, right? Where it's predominantly secondary Sangic. Right? That happens naturally. Right? So the artificial of having Adam and Eve's descendants favor the Northern European blue man stock and, right, and get you the Caucasoid, and then the other two happen naturally, the Mongoloid and the Negroid. Right? And again, remind yourself of it, because of that commonality of mind despite the differences, say amongst the secondary Sangics, there's going to be some commonality of features. There's going to be differences between orange, green, and indigo, but there's going to be some things in common, right? You know, that kind, those basic Negroid, you know, body characteristics that we notice, or those basic Mongoloid body characteristics. You know, if you saw a pure blue man, you go, oh, he does have kind of the red or yellow man, right? He's going to have that kind of Mongoloid sort of body shape, you know, the way they're chiseled and whatnot, right? You get some blue man in Northern Europe, and you know, and you can even get some, you know, some slanted eye sort of thing, you know, in that Northern European stock from the blue man there, just like yellow man has. Right, so there's some things, right? There's some things in common, and because, see, they, you know, I like you because you kind of look like me a little bit. You think a little differently, but you think a little bit the same too. You like to think about longer term things rather than kind of being stuck in the moment. And you kind of look like me a little bit. I think I want to mate with you, right? So that's the way it happens naturally, right? You're looking for something that kind of reminds you of you, and we still do that, right? You look at the engagement announcements in the newspaper, you know, and everyone thinks the older the couple gets, the more they look like each other. No, look at engagement announcements, right? They look like each other to begin with, right? I mean, we're just naturally attracted to something that looks like us. Neither the boy or the girl recognize that, you know, why it is that that person is so beautiful. It's because they're looking in a mirror.
That has to do with your dog.
and you naturally, right, unconsciously pick a dog that, you know, looks like you, yeah. Right? I mean, we just naturally do that, right? Right.
They're all cute.
Okay.
The more backward humans are usually employed as laborers by the more progressive races. This accounts for the origin of slavery on the planets during the early ages. The orange men are usually subdued by the red and reduced to the status of servants, sometimes exterminated. The yellow and red men often fraternize, but not always. The yellow race usually enslaves the green, while the blue man subdues the indigo. These races of primitive men think no more of utilizing the services of their backward fellows in compulsory labor than your ancients would of buying and selling horses and cattle.
It's all very matter of fact. You know, and you know, it's not right here, but remember when you get into civilization papers, slavery is one of the four indispensables to early progress. You know, and you can't get anywhere on a world. You can't get any world going in civilization without slavery. Every world has slavery to begin with. It's indispensable part of the very beginning process. And coincidentally, if you've got all six races, it all works really handy. Red man comes out, gets himself all going, and shortly thereafter, orange man appears. He goes, "Ooh, I've got slaves. God gave me slaves." You know, and so they're all happy. You know, they're chugging along. Red man enslaving orange man. You know, and then along comes yellow man. You know, and he gets himself going. And says, "You know what? I need to move towards agriculture. You know, now boy, it'd be handy if I had some slaves." Ta-da! There's green man, sent by God to be your slaves. And blue and indigo, same way. Right? See, they naturally come out in that order. So normally your primary sanghic is gonna, you know, start with gathering and going to hunting, you know, and then moving to herding, you know, and when he really needs slaves to begin to move to farming, you know, to move to agriculture, right? You're gonna need that, because early on you don't have international harvester, right? The only way to get going with agriculture is through slavery. Right, so so you think about how on those worlds that only have the three, they have to have slavery too to begin with. Right, so primary sanghics are going to be more enslaved on those worlds than on a world with six. But isn't it interesting that, when we think of slavery, we so much think of Europeans enslaving Africans, kind of quote unquote blue man, kind of quote unquote enslaving indigo man. Right? I mean, it's kind of just natural on every world that something akin to the kind of slavery that we think of in the Western world,
Well, it's not often discussed, but in the northern part of the United States, they didn't have slavery as such, right. But indentured servitude was right. Very strongly
right.
Used and enforced.
Yeah.
That's how they got passage for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and so when you think about it, I mean, when Europeans were kind of just enslaving lesser Europeans, you know, in indentured servitude, it's actually kind of part of the natural evolution to go through the colonial period and really kind of get the whole primary to secondary sanghic differential in play and work through that, you know, get that in play. The inevitabilities come into play then. You've got the differential, and eventually it sparks an awakening. Wait a minute, this doesn't feel right. Right? You know, it's a natural part of the process. Right? You know, there's no way that you can get that higher recognition of a more idealistic behavior, a more altruistic behavior, until you literally experience the differential. So that's another reason why slavery is indispensable. I mean, initially it all starts out matter of fact. No one's thinking about it at all. No one's reflectively thinking. But eventually mankind starts to think reflectively. And coincidentally, quote unquote, there's this contrast right in front of them. It's a very immediate low-hanging fruit for your reflective thinking. As I reflect on the differential between me, the master, and my slaves, I feel a tension. Right? And that gets you going. And you go, I don't like that tension. I think we should go up. Right? But if there's no tension to ever feel, no one will ever choose to go up. You'll just say, lay there in the plane forever, right? The salubrious climb of ignorance. And so it's all part of the process. But when your spiritual idealism doesn't like slavery, right now, definitely not. But it's a very important, indispensable part of the process.
But Chris?
Yep.
It came in too close to the times we're in. It should have been earlier.
Right, of course. Right.
And that's why it was so screwed up and fought so quickly.
But quote unquote screwed up, of course, is no, that's the difference of our world. On our world, we work through slavery when there's people that are much more spiritually conscious. And so we actualize potentials that are not normally actualized. I mean, normally kind of slavery gets outlawed for you. We had to discover it ourselves and outlaw it ourselves.
Yeah, in our recent.
You know, we weren't told to outlaw it by Adam and Eve. We had to figure that out ourselves. So we actualize potentials here that normally don't get actualized.
Yeah. There's something that's much more fundamental, though, and that's the use of tools and machines. That's what made slavery obsolete, because they weren't necessary.
Right. See, notice that, right? I mean, there were idealistic people long before, but it was, not time yet. I mean, you can't actually outlaw slavery until you are, until it's possible to outlaw slavery so that you don't starve to death. So as soon as we had the technology where we could outlaw it, we did. Right? This all happens naturally. Right? And so people that are still very primitive on the planet and haven't gone through all these stages, you can't just go in and and short-circuit this. They've got to go through this process. You're short-circuiting the potentials that God built in it, those unattainable expressions that they were just talking about. Right? Let's see. Oh, maybe just one before I don't forget. Remember, Adam and Eve, like I just told you, have a lot to do with getting rid of slavery. They also have everything to do with developing technology, right? See, so they give they teach people the technology so they don't need slaves anymore, and then they can give up on slaves. It goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Oh, did you have something there? I'm sorry.
When you were just saying that we had to figure out the tension and that make a change from slavery without right. Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
That's a real good example of what we just read not too long ago about the benefit of having to do things as Agendaughters.
Right. Right. To actually be a people who, in and of their own recognition, chose to outlaw slavery. There's not many people like that in the universe of universes. Most people never got that kind of recognition, on their own, courageously and independently. Yep. Okay.
On most normal worlds, involuntary servitude does not survive the dispensation of the planetary prince. Although mental defectives and social delinquents are often still compelled to perform involuntary labor. But on all normal spheres, this sort of primitive slavery is abolished soon after the arrival of the imported violet or Adamic race.
Okay, so we already kind of talked about that. See, so it's, depending on the world, it might be kind of dwindling during the prince's, the post-planetary prince, age. But it definitely is going to, go away with Adam and Eve. And see, you can ask why, and we just talked about that. Why could you definitively get rid of slavery once you have Adam and Eve? Because you now have the technology, right? You're not going to get rid of slavery and go back to being hunter-gatherers, right? You're not going to go back and, lose all of your civilizational advancement. You can replace the slaves and keep going forward.
Plus, Adam and Eve labored.
Right, and they taught people.
Honored.
Right, all these things, yeah, right. So, see how it all works together. Okay, and then they're we're going to focus on this other issue that we haven't totally focused on yet. Although mental defectives and social delinquents are often still compelled to perform involuntary labor. So, you know, that transitioning from enslaving, say, the secondary Sangiks and enslaving the lesser independent of race, you know, is kind of a transitional thing. But, of course, Adam and Eve are going to work on getting rid of all of the mental defectives and social delinquents. And see, so again, you know, there aren't any of those to enslave anymore, even if the people still might have a tendency to look down upon them or even to recognize kind of pragmatically, well, there's really nothing they can do but indentured servitude. You know, it's just not in play anymore because there aren't any of those inferior peoples. Okay, so it all works together. Just naturally, everything evolves away in you know, in unison. All right.
These six evolutionary races are destined to be blended and exalted by amalgamation with the progeny of the Adamic uplifters. But before these peoples are blended, the inferior and unfit are largely eliminated. The planetary prince and the material sun, with other suitable planetary authorities, pass upon the fitness of the reproducing strains. The difficulty of executing such a radical program on Urantia consists in the absence of competent judges to pass upon the biologic fitness or unfitness of the individuals of your world races. Notwithstanding this obstacle, it seems that you ought to be able to agree upon the biologic disfellowshipping of your more markedly unfit, defective, degenerate, and antisocial stocks.
Okay, so notice initially they're saying inferior and unfit, you know, and this kind of giving shades of sort of vertical and horizontally, no matter, you know, what the issue is. And then they kind of just double down in any way, shape, or form with that last bit of unfit, defective, degenerate, and antisocial. You know, and you had the antisocial before, remember the social delinquents that they mentioned in the previous paragraph. Right, so, you know, like I've said before, I mean, you, one of the first things that Adam and Eve have to do is limit the procreation of the lesser stocks, or lesser individuals amongst the stocks, maybe I should say it that way. You know, because if you don't, you've got this problem of, you know, there's always going to be recessive-recessive pairings. And you don't want those, you know, you don't want negative recessive characteristics. So you got to get rid of all those negative recessive characteristics. You know, Adam and Eve can blend amongst themselves. I mean, the children of Adam and Eve can you know, sister can breed with brother, you know, etc. with the Adamites, because there's no negative recessive genes. Right? The problem with inbreeding like that is negative recessive genes. Right? They don't have any, so there's no issue. Right? And so even if you're talking about trying to improve the indigo race before you start blending indigo with whomever, you know, whatever Adam and Eve are going to do, right? I mean, the first issue is to, you know, get rid of most of the lesser elements. But that you don't get rid of all that lesser element all up front, because that's a relative thing. You know, it's lesser, okay? That's relative, right? In your enlightened life, there are still lesser genetics that you're trying to eliminate, you know, and those people can't procreate as much as the better stocks, and, you know, that goes on forever. It's just that in enlightened life, the most unfit stock there is so beyond any of us, right? We can't even imagine, right? None of us would be allowed to breed with anyone on a world enlightened life. We are so hopelessly inferior genetically, right? I often joke, you know, if you went on a journey to a world enlightened life, the first thing they do when they get you there is put you in a hermetically sealed, you know, container, Right? I mean, you're just a cancer in every way, shape, and form, right? I mean, everything about you is unfit, right? Don't touch anything. Don't breathe. Don't right? You're just a contaminant, right? And so, you know, so this is a long-term process, but the really crude, you know, lesser stock, you know, is gotten rid of in short order before you have one race.
Is that what disfellowshipping is?
Yeah, the disfellowshipping is just, you know, you don't kill them, you just don't let them procreate. Biologic disfellowshipping. You know, quote-unquote fellowshipping, like, you know, liaison, that kind of fellowshipping. No sexual liaison for you. No fellowshipping like that, right? Right. You just, you know, you don't allow them to procreate. You know, maybe not at all, or at least less than the norm. You know, and the way a wise leaders like they're talking about, which we don't have, you know, they tend to do it where they don't just cut everyone off. They just, you know, you can have two kids, you can have five. You know, you lesser stock can only have two. And the reason that they don't just cut it off is because even though it's lesser, it doesn't mean it's devoid of potential. Right? It's not wholly wanting. Right? So you want to allow a little bit of procreation in that lesser stock. And the way it normally. But now here they're saying, you know, I mean, there would be no problem. It's like, you know, you don't know any of the details. Like, you know, these wise judges, they're, you know, competent judges they're talking about here. I mean, none of us know, like we were just saying, exactly how mind, adjutant mind attunes to genetics, you know, so what is better and, you know, what's worse. We don't know any of that stuff. But you can at least take the low-hanging fruit, right? I mean, you know, it, you know what's really, really not going to be helpful. And probably the most challenging thing there, I mean, words like defective and degenerate and unfit are politically incorrect. You know, so we feel a lot of tension in, with those words, you know, or retarded or words like that. It, but antisocial, you know, recognize with our unwise spiritual consciousness that we have on this planet, there's actually a tendency to exalt antisocial individuals. You know, and we hold them up as, you know, that these are people that are, you know, are trying to make a difference. And, you know, no, they're saying that you should biologically disfellowship people who have antisocial tendencies, who don't want to conform to the mores. Remember what antisocial means, right? No matter what the more is, you don't want to conform to it. You know, you're not the boss of me. So think about how politically incorrect that statement really is. To say that you know, you that are out there protesting against the current mores system, I think maybe you shouldn't procreate. Do you think you could say that in public and not be crucified?
Or at least disfellowship.
Star Wars or Spielberg, they ought to do a movie on how we disfellowship.
And we all know this is all hyper-problematic because of, you know, the eugenics, you know, stuff being led astray by the Nazis and stuff. But just, you know, let it sink in. What's kind of a challenging thing? I mean, they're pointing out that, yes, the mores system that a culture has at a particular time might not be like they have in Havona. It might be far from idyllic. But it is the stabilizing mores system of the time. And a culture has the right to not allow those who will not conform to that social structure to not procreate. A society has the right to do that.
But the social structure has to change.
Yes, it does.
Right. And you have to be one of the ones to help change it, possibly.
Yes.
And you might have to protest against tyranny.
So how do you do that?
That's so the right. See, I didn't want to answer. See, I just wanted to open. I wanted to open up that can of worms. I'm trying to say, is this a trivial thing they're asking us to do here? How do we determine? How would we determine such things?
Right. I mean, you just bow down to.
I mean, there would be a tendency whoever's in, you know, whatever side of the dichotomy is in charge would want to, you know, keep the other side of the dichotomy from procreating.
Antisocial.
I I mean,
if the Democrats are in charge, they would not allow Republicans to procreate.
I don't think it applies.
You know, or something like that.
But, right? I mean,
it's not applying.
Okay, I'm not trying to apply it anyway. I'm just trying to open up the can of worms. I'm just trying to point out.
But you said protesters against the mores, sometimes that is exactly what.
I know.
Change. You have to, I mean,
you're saying that I said a dichotomy and I didn't.
You did.
I said that some of those protesters apparently probably, matter of fact, remember, if they're too problematic, the secondary midwares will thwart them. Okay, I mean, they're telling you something that's really inscrutable. It's like, well, how do I know if this is protesting, if this is appropriate for the mores to be challenged like this so that we can make progress? How do I know when it's not appropriate?
Okay, you open the can of worms.
This is really complicated.
All
right.
The difficulty of executing such a radical program on your ranch consists in the absence of competent judges.
Right, right. But they are saying that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven. That if we say, well, this is great, 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 but I'm going to take the end point, the most antisocial of the antisocial, they're saying, if you decide to just not let them procreate, no one in heaven is going to, think ill of you. They're telling us to not be afraid to start on this, okay? And that person that you're going to tell they can't procreate is not going to like it. They're going to be kicking and screaming, right?
We immediately
think of some sort of totalitarian, oppressive state or something. Just look at how problematic these statements are. Look how problematic these statements are.
You can have someone institutionalized because they can't take care of themselves, mm-hmm. but biologically they can still procreate. It's okay if you fix them so that they don't start having babies.
Everyone knows that we used to actually do this. In the early part of the 20th century, we found people we thought were unfit, defective, degenerate, and we didn't let them procreate. But then we got more spiritually conscious, and we thought, oh, that's horrible. Who are we to judge them, right? And so now we just let anyone procreate again. Well, don't be surprised if things get worse, right? You don't have, they're telling you, you don't have a right to procreate. That can be regulated by society, okay? Let's see if we can get a little bit of this next section here.
Section 5, racial amalgamation, bestowal of the Adamic blood. When a planetary Adam and Eve arrive on an inhabited world, they have been fully instructed by their superiors as to the best way to effect the improvement of the existing races of intelligent beings. The plan of procedure is not uniform. Much is left to the judgment of the ministering pair, and mistakes are not infrequent, especially on disordered, insurrectionary worlds such as Urantia.
But not always, not totally there. And so again, this is, I told you we were beginning to this here soon, right? Adam and Eve, don't have some sort of precise plan, that from their superiors, and do only this, follow this to the letter. Their superiors give him kind of just a rough outline, and then the rest of it is their free will choice. They decide, well, I think 50% of this race is going to be able to procreate at twice the rate. They can make all these decisions, and sometimes they make mistakes. Sometimes they do things that disrupt the unity. Not just an error, not just unwise judgment, not just error, but mistaken judgment. Notice they use the word judgment there, right? Evil. Sometimes, right? So evil is a natural part of the Adamic ministry. Come on, just to sink in, right? It isn't set up, it isn't so micromanaged by their superiors that prevents them from unwittingly doing what's bad, right? They're not going to sin, they don't consciously do what's bad, but sometimes they do something that is actually bad, not just false, but bad, right? And that's part of the evolutionary process. And why? It's like, well, why would their superiors not rein them in? Why would they not? I mean, you know, there's beings on high that could look at a particular judgment of an Adam and Eve and say, no, that's unwise or whatever. But they don't tell them that. Why do they give them that kind of free rein? Because even those very high superiors don't see things in the wholeness of the supreme. You can't judge everything. I mean, even an Ancient of Days doesn't have the perspective that the Supreme Being does on the totality of the finite. Some things you have to just trust. It's free will. You got to let it just play out.
Though Saloni did say don't stray.
Right. There are some definitive boundaries, right? But, you know, they don't micromanage everyone, right? It's part of the process, right? So, I mean, maybe one of the things you can take away from that is don't be so afraid to make a mistake. They let Adam and Eve make mistakes, okay? And we're not just talking boo-boos. I mean, actual mistakes, you know, mistaken judgment, evil. It's okay. You didn't do it willingly. It's part of the process. Do it, suffer the unfortunate consequences, and through that tribulation, be wiser. Right? It's part of the process. Don't be afraid to just try something. They're trying to encourage. We've gotten so hyper-idealistic, we're afraid to do anything anymore. It's like, well, what if it doesn't work out like we were imagining? You know, and we're just grinding to a halt. Everyone's afraid to act anymore. Right? You can't even get Congress to pass a bill anymore because everyone's so afraid. It's like, well, what if this happens and what if that happens? We just are caught in an endless tail-chasing cycle. No one has the courage to act anymore. You know, and we think it's horrid if someone fails. You should be publicly mocked if you've ever done something and failed. Huh?
We end up in media.
Right? I mean, this is so insane. Right? You can't fiat Havona into existence. It's an evolutionary process. You achieve a Havona-like state in this world through unwise judgment and mistaken judgment. That's how you get there. You got to let it happen. Right?
Just what comes to mind is for every adversity is an equal or greater equivalent. And I take refuge in that.
we're just so afraid anymore, right? You know? You've got to, you know, that idealism has its place, right? It's for spirit. It's not for matter. The matter needs to rattle about, okay? Stop trying to impose spirit upon matter like that. Let matter be more. It's got to have, that's the whole point of this country, is to actually have the freedom to make a mistake, to not be so totalitarianly oppressed that you can't make a mistake. Right? The whole point of this country is to have trust in God and open up things. Let it happen. Let people try and fail. Right? You can't set up a system where no business ever fails. That's insanity. You will lose all your freedom. You know? All right, anyway.
Since you said be courageous, and when you make mistakes, you can be drugged so far through so much pain. And
quiet down there.
It's not easy, but it'd be nice to have not worry about the pain that you're going to suffer when you make a mistake. I also, on the flip side of that, realize that without that, there wouldn't be growth. But sometimes the pain it doesn't quit, and you just keep being drugged through and drugged through and drugged through, even though you love the other people, forgive the other people, try to apologize on your knees or whatever, and you can't, I know you can't determine their reaction. You can only do your side of it. But and there's going to be great growth at the end of that. That's the reason to have the courage and the independent thinking on it. But
the whole point of it.
The whole political correct system politically has evolved because of this. And it just suffocates what you can do. It's not what you can do, but what most people are willing to risk.
Yeah, it just,
so I'm speaking of
no, the whole,
my heart.
Yeah, right, yeah, and just recognize that the whole point of adversity is not for you to fix other things.
And I wasn't saying that.
I know. I'm just adding to what you're saying. Just the whole point of adversity is for you to have an opportunity to respond positively to something that naturally would produce a negative feeling in your mind. That's the whole point, right? We have to just, you know, find the courage to respond positively to a negative stimulus instead of just doing what comes naturally, responding negatively to a negative stimulus.
You look for the equal equivalent. That's what you look for.
Right. I believe
and
good
it's, and
equal.
It's always there.
What do you mean by the equal equivalent?
A greater or equal equivalent. For every adversity, there's an equal or greater equivalent, which is not an adversity.
Yeah. Right. See it as a potential, a positive potential, rather than a negative actual.
And I was saying that very thing.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep going here.
Usually the violet peoples do not begin to amalgamate with the planetary natives till their own group numbers over 1 million. But in the meantime, the staff of the planetary prince proclaims that the children of the gods have come down, as it were, to be one with the races of men. And the people eagerly look forward to the day when announcements will be made that those who have qualified as belonging to the superior racial strains may proceed to the Garden of Eden and be there chosen by the sons and daughters of Adam as the evolutionary fathers and mothers of the new and blended order of mankind.
Remember how we mentioned last week it came up, that whole bit about 1 million.
Yeah.
Right? And and just notice the spirit of that paragraph. Very early on, everyone really thinks that eugenics is cool. And the whole culture of the planet shifts. And everyone becomes motivated by, I want to be found to be well-born. Right? Yeah, eugenics. Adam and Eve, create this whole new spirit of excitement on the planet, I don't want to be found to be antisocial. I want to try to be really the most upstanding member of my community so that maybe I'll be picked to have sex with those fancy people in the garden. Okay? All right, keep going.
On normal worlds, the planetary Adam and Eve never mate with the evolutionary races. This work of biologic betterment is a function of the Adamic progeny. But these Adamites do not go out among the races. The prince's staff bring to the Garden of Eden the superior men and women for voluntary mating with the Adamic offspring. And on most worlds, it is considered the highest honor to be selected as a candidate for mating with the sons and daughters of the garden.
Okay, kind of was pointing out that last part. I think everyone really gets into this. It's the highest honor. Everyone is really excited about this, motivated by this, and that whole bit about they don't go out really. Select individuals are brought in, and we've talked about that's kind of the general way that the first two dispensations go. It isn't so much of a going out with either the prince's staff or Adam and Eve. It's a select coming in and lift it up, and then they send them back out again.
There's something about that that's right, because what they have, they value what they are and what they have.
Yeah.
And when you value something, it's only right that they should come to that rather than take it out.
Right, right. You're not just giving them this uplift for free. Right? You're challenging them to look up to it and strive up, you know, meet Adam and Eve halfway. Strive up. Right? You're challenging them. You're not just giving it to them, you know, without any effort. And so you're encouraging this, getting them all to be oriented upward more. And we talked about that last time with the million, you know, that you basically have to get a kind of a full whole race going before you start doing this blending. Why? Because you need that many generations to have the descendants of Adam and Eve kind of settle in to the relationship with this world, settle into synchrony with this world.
Council, do at least half a million,
Our planet, there was all kinds of special things and whatnot, you know. Yeah, there was all these extra things that went on this planet. But see, the general thing is to kind of get a full-blown race-sized group of people. That stock is breeding within themselves, and so they've kind of come into synchrony with the adjutant mind on this world and everything. Remember, the adjutant mind is different from world to world and all that sort of stuff. So you have to get them equilibrated to the local conditions, and then they mate. And so it's not only a problem for our Adam and Eve to have directly mated, but you see, just because there's that too much differential, because you haven't downstepped to the children yet, but you don't have an equilibrated Adamic stock. See, so there's even more tension. Okay, all right. So like we talked about that last time. All right, let's see some more here.
For the first time, the racial wars and other tribal struggles are diminished, while the world races increasingly strive to qualify for recognition and admission to the garden. You can at best have but a very meager idea of how this competitive struggle comes to occupy the center of all activities on a normal planet. This whole scheme of race improvement was early wrecked on Urantia.
How powerful is it? Look at that. I mean, people are literally so intrigued by eugenics that they stop warring amongst each other. They're really intrigued by this idea of, ooh, I instead of fighting on the plane, I love this orienting myself upward. It's so intriguing to orient themselves upward. That they forget about this fighting on the plane. You start to lose this horizontal, you know, back and forth of war amongst the races. You get everyone oriented upward, and no one is looking. You're different than me, and I don't like that. Right? If everyone is looking up to the common goal, you stop fixating on these differences and turning those molehills into mountains down on the plane.
The same thing happened. Mm-hmm. Right.
Everyone knows how that works. You get people to look up and
completely quit. Yeah. And people were like, usually when you have a hard time getting into traffic or something, they were just, people would let you in, people would help one another.
Right.
The whole dynamic shifted.
That's why it's so important to orient. We want people to be upists. Right? A lot of the problems will naturally go away. Don't try to fix the problems in the plane. Forget about that. Just get everyone to look up, and the problems naturally go away, right? You know, and the energy in that plane is the sixth adjutant, the zeal of, you know, it's zeal that, you know, breeds war. Get them looking up to the philosophic impulse. Look up out of the plane of feelings, and go up.
The violet race is a monogamous people. And every evolutionary man or woman uniting with the Adamic sons and daughters pledges not to take other mates and to instruct his or her children in single-matedness. The children of each of these unions are educated and trained in the schools of the planetary prince and then are permitted to go forth to the race of their evolutionary parent, there to marry among the selected groups of superior mortals.
Okay, so again, you see more of the how they do this, bringing them in, lifting them up, and sending them out. And you know, you've got You've got one of the you know, the beginnings, remember, of a more advanced civilization with those advanced indispensables of true monogamy, right? I mean, evolutionary stock is not naturally monogamous. Adamic stock is naturally monogamous, right? Evolutionary stock has to choose monogamy. It's not natural, like it is with Adamic stock. And the same, so at the same time you're getting that true monogamy, you remember the other one, you know, the first of those four advanced ones, true religion, true monogamy. Again, the religion thing we were just kind of alluding to, right? We have these delusions that if we just get each religion to definitively appreciate their differences in the plane, there will be peace on earth. No, the more you focus on how that religion is different than yours, the more you'll hate that. You know, I mean, the answer is not, you know, multiculturalism in the plane, right? You got to get every religion to go up and transcend those differences, right? The answer to religious tensions is not, you know, religious understanding. You have to go up to philosophy, right? Go up above the religious impulse to the philosophic impulse, right? You know, and in the context of a philosophic impulse, there can begin to be true religion, right? The one religion that transcends all those religions of the plane, all those religions that are predicated on the biases of adjutant mind, right?
Mind religions.
Right. Religions of the mind. That's why there's different religions. If there was any religion on the of the spirit on this planet, there would be only one religion. Right? Religions of the mind are different. Right? It's like, yes, but we call ourselves spiritual. Yeah, but that's because you're using spirit for fancy mind. Right? Religion of the spirit is not the religion of fancy mind. It's the religion of that substance in the external world, that other substance. Right? It transcends those mindal differences. So, again, the answer is to, you know, see, Adam and Eve, you see, are working on trying to get people oriented up. Because after all, the seventh adjutant is above this, the first six.
It's like Jesus, you don't have to all think alike to be alike.
Right. Starts out by looking up to the common ideal, and eventually you'll get up to a common philosophy predicated on that common ideal. Right? You'll be kindred minds. Right? But it starts with kindred spirits. Right? And kindred spirits, not, well, let's pretend that the minds in the plane are the same, and there's peace on earth, in a, you know, in our rose-colored glasses point of view. No. Okay, anyway.
When this strain of the material suns is added to the evolving races of the worlds, a new and greater era of evolutionary progress is initiated. Following this procreative outpouring of imported ability and super-evolutionary traits, there ensues a succession of rapid strides in civilization and racial development. In 100,000 years, more progress is made than in a million years of former struggle. In your world, even in the face of the miscarriage of the ordained plans, great progress has been made since the gift of to your peoples of Adam's life plasm.
And like we mentioned, part of that is because of the andonite stock that kind of primed the pump a bit, right? So that a little bit of Adamic blood could go farther than it would normally, okay? I mean, a lot of that is pretty straightforward. We kind of talked about it a lot. I mean, you've got this whole, you know, getting civilization really going because you're going to get technology really going and stuff, right? I mean, that whole scientific advancement that Adam and Eve oversee. Probably the most important thing in there, though, is the time scales. Okay. Your spiritual consciousness does not like numbers like that.
Yeah,
like it hates numbers like that, right? Look at the kind of challenge they're trying to give you about time scales. I mean, okay, so let's imagine a million years, you know, flopping about, okay, and then finally Adam and Eve are going to improve things, and then there's 100,000 years, and now finally things are really kind of getting going. Okay. I mean, you can't think that light and life is, you know, is just around the corner, right? You know, there's these timescales are huge, Right? Normally there's thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, right, involved. I mean, yeah, the normal post-planetary prince ages, you know, on average about 500,000 years. But it can be longer and stuff. You notice they kind of just, you know, they just said, well, imagine you got like a million years, okay? And then things are going to start to improve, and after 100,000 years, things will be better. Right? I mean, do you think like that? Or when, you know, when do we want, you know, what do we want, Havona? When do we want it now? Right? Right. No one is out there chanting, what do we want, Havona? When do we want it? 100,000 years from now. No one is saying that. No one can suffer a time scale longer than 100 years. Just like Adam and Eve couldn't. If it's going to take more than 100 years, you're not interested. As a matter of fact, you're pretty sure it's evil if it's someone is suggesting it's going to take more than 100 years to happen. Right? No. You know, it takes thousands and thousands, tens of thousands. Right? I mean, you'll be so far in your, you know, ascension career before this world is light and life. Think how far down the road you're going to be before this world is a light and life.
Maybe we'll come back around.
You might come back here as a finaliter and help, right? Help getting things.
Seriously? Yeah. Right?
No, I'm being a little facetious. Remember, you have to do the other six super universes before you can come back to this super universe. But
wait a minute, Adam and Eve. It's been about 37,000 years since Adam and Eve came, and we're retarded. So.
I mean,
that gives you an idea.
I mean, normally it takes Adam and Eve 25,000 years to do what they're supposed to do. Normally it takes them 25,000 years to do what they're supposed to do. And then you've got all of the magisterial son, bestowal son, trinity teacher son stuff, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Right? Yeah, we'll get to that paper, remember, that's coming up, you know. All right, anyway, you get the point. You know, you need to temper your spiritual idealism with some material pragmatism. You got to take account of time.
We need to get to the starting point.
Right. I mean, we haven't even gotten to the starting point, you know, of the 100,000 years, right? I mean, we and you're wanting the 100,000 years to be over. Okay. Let's wrap it up here.
But while the pure line children of a planetary Garden of Eden can bestow themselves upon the superior members of the evolutionary races and thereby upstep the biologic level of mankind, it would not prove beneficial for the higher strains of Urantia mortals to mate with the lower races. Such an unwise procedure would jeopardize all civilization on your world. Having failed to achieve race harmonization by the Adamic technique, you must now work out your evolution, your planetary problem of race improvement by other and largely human methods of adaptation and control.
We've talked about that. I bring that up a lot. Remember, that's the whole point, because we didn't get the Adamic uplift. We have to go through the eugenics process as much as we can on our own till we get some help, and we'll go through that some more. And then there's all of the genetic engineering, right, all that, and we've got it all. We're not going to get the fiat thing of the Adamic technique.
Darn.
Okay. You know, and notice the thing in there, jeopardize civilization. Remember, that's the whole thing. The reason this book is in my lap is because civilization is in jeopardy. Another reason why it's in jeopardy is because we've decided that all men are born equal, and therefore we should just indiscriminately mate amongst ourselves. Right? Right, every civilization in human history has collapsed because of indiscriminate mating. Right, everyone mated with the slaves, and that was the end of the civilization. Right, that's the hard truth of it. Humans used to know that. You know, and the full recognition of that is what got eugenics going in the beginning of the 20th century. Then we got all falsely idealistic. And we've got some really tough stuff to, you know, to come to terms with again, to face the facts again. You know, and why is this fundamentally? Is it fundamentally a problem to mate with the lower races because they're lower? No, that's the whole point, is have that differential. That was the potential we were talking about. What's the fundamental problem of just indiscriminately mating on this planet? Well, you're unfit, defective, degenerate. The problem is the negative recessive genetics, right? So that you won't get the super additive consequence you're looking for. It's going to go down instead of up. And that downward pull is going to drag everything down, and there will be no civilization, right? Because civilization is a choice, and there will be no one that is in the mode of choosing. Everyone will just be what comes natural, and what comes natural is not civilization.
Except right? for royalty. They mated among themselves and got a bunch of idiots.
Well, again, even the higher strains, have to be careful about too much inbreeding because of the negative genetics, right? The negative recessive genetics.
They kind of tried it.
Right. Again, I mean, but it's even more so, if not only do you have, it's bad enough just negative recessive within better stock, but if you add the negative recessive plus a lower sangic downpole, it doubles the problem. And that's what they're getting at.
And it's a societal problem, because when it came time for me to choose a mate, I was just looking at the individual. I didn't look at the family.
You weren't thinking genetically.
I wasn't thinking genetically. You or she. And nobody's going to tell me what to do.
Right. If I want to mate with that, I'm going to mate with that, damn it.
Any social
there. Unbridled.
Everyone knows that the guy, nobility, used to have lots of notions like this, where everyone was really concerned. Well, no, you shouldn't, mate with that because they're not of noble birth or whatever. Yeah, okay, some of the notions they had were false. Okay, but just because some people had false notions along that line doesn't mean that whole concept is false, right? You need to think about genetics. Don't just mate with something that has the other kind of genitalia. I mean, there has to be more consideration than that, right?
To keep arranged marriages.
You got to think about this some, right? And Jean is making a great point. Don't just look at the individual. You need to look at the whole family lineage. Right, that individual might be one of those rare recessive positive individuals, and everyone else in their family tree is less than optimal. May not want to mate with that thing. You got to think about this stuff.
Yeah, but if you do, then you still get more potential. I mean, right. That's the thing.
Right.
Just
right. Yeah. But it's not a simplistic thing, right? Mm. You remember how they tell you? I mean, definitely don't think, well, only the nobility, quote unquote, should mate. No. I mean, the real potential is in the middle, right? It's not in the very lesser or the very greater. The very lesser doesn't have any potential, and the very greater has already actualized their potential. Neither of those have potential, right? The potential lies in the great middle. But still. Everyone needs to start thinking about this again. We have to overcome our cultural bias against thinking about it. We have to start thinking about this.
Easier said than done.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's no way you're going to institute this universally. But this isn't a dispensational revelation. It's not meant for everyone. But for those who awaken to this, you can start considering this. You don't have to convince everyone in your town to think like this. You start thinking like this.
Just those who haven't started procreating.
And that which you decide on earth in our ignorance is honored in heaven. I mean, right. Water under the bridge is water under the bridge. But,
look around, you can envision that it isn't going in the right direction at the present time. And I don't think that, as you mentioned earlier, I don't think the Second World War helped out either. The whole Hitler aspect of genetics really put a damper in people's minds.
Yeah, if anything, that just makes it obvious that you shouldn't try to do this in some sort of a universal way. It kind of forces you to recognize, you need to do it in a, you know, in a more individualized way. Right? And try to find the wisdom. Don't try to make everyone else wise. All right. Thanks everyone for letting us run over a little bit there. All right, we'll get into the rest of this next time. It has a little less of the intense controversy that these sections do. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.